Now, I've given as a title for tonight's study the one that is announced in the grapevine, namely Creation Truth and Creation Fiction. And you'll see in a minute why I've done that. Now, we're looking briefly at Psalm 115, and we see what Psalm 115 says about other religions, the idolatrous religions. It says, in contrast, you see in verse 3, our God is in heaven. He does whatever pleases him. In other words, God is in control, and he rules the whole universe. But their idols are silver and gold, the most precious metals known to human beings. But they are made by the hands of men. They have mouths, but cannot speak, eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but cannot hear, noses, but they cannot smell. They have hands, but cannot feel, feet, but they cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. And then he goes on to say, those who make them will be like them, dead. There is a spiritual death appertaining to the worshippers of idols. And so will all who trust in them be likewise spiritually dead. Now maybe some of you have gone to other countries and have seen images of the gods worshipped in those countries. And you may have thought they were interesting, you may have thought they were beautiful, you may have thought they were ugly. But they have no meaning for you because you're a visitor and you come back to this country. But when the psalm writer was writing this psalm, he was in a country which was being tempted to worship idols because all countries around were worshipping idols. And they were in living, trading relationship with the countries around. And there was always the danger of them being supremely influenced by the culture of the countries around. But Israel was called to be a separate people, my people, a chosen people, says God, out from the nations of the world. But Israel's sin was always to compromise and to become like the nations of the world. Now, there you have the difference given to you between God, who is in the heaven and who does what he pleases, and the dumb idols that do not influence man really. Now, the exhortation, therefore, in verse 9, O house of Israel, trust in the Lord. He is their help and shield. O house of Aaron, trust in the Lord. He is their help and shield. You who fear him, trust in the Lord. He is their help and shield. So the difference between the living God, who is a real help, and the dumb idols who cannot help you. And that's the contrast drawn starkly in that psalm. Now we've been looking at the first three chapters of Genesis, and we've looked at the creation truth, the revelation of God as to how he created this world. Now there are other creation stories throughout the world. You'll find them among the Australian Aborigines, you'll find them among the American Indians, you'll find them in all parts of the world. And some of them are very, very strange and very divorced from the biblical account. But in the areas around Israel, there were biblical, there were creation stories, and scholars have claimed that there is a relationship between these creation stories and the biblical account. Now, I don't think there is, but that is a popular theory at the moment, and I'll come back to it in a minute. So I'm going to choose one of these creation stories for you to see what it was like and for you to see for yourself the remarkable difference between this Babylonian creation story and the one that we've been studying in the Bible. So at this juncture, we'll just have it flashed on from the overhead projector. Now here is a list of some of the Babylonian gods. Can you see there? The pantheon, that is the family of gods. There's Apsu, who is supposed to represent sweet water, although the more recent scholars tend to doubt whether that is true. So there is a discussion and a dispute among scholars upon this, but we won't go into that scholastic debate tonight. And the Apsu is the god and his wife Tiamat, who is supposed to represent salt water, and their son Mumu, mist. You see the combination of sweet water, salt water producing mist. Then there's a brother and sister who got married, Lamu and Lahamu, and another brother and sister who got married, Anshar and Kishar. Now, their son, Anshar and Kishar, was Anu, the sky god. His son was Ea, the god of wisdom, and his son, Marduk, who became the chief of the gods. Now, all this is found in a poem, an epic poem of just over 1,000 lines, and it's called Enuma Elish. Now, Enuma Elish are the opening words, and it means when on high, so it's the beginning of a sentence. That's all it is. It's the opening words of an Akkadian epic poem. Now, Akkadian is the word used by scholars for several related languages, Assyrian, Babylonian, and other dialects that stem from them. And so the story is called by scholars the Babylonian story of creation. Now, I want to tell you what the story is very quickly. We read that Apsu and his wife, as gods, became old, right? And as they became old, they were fed up with a young god's hilarious noise. And Apsu was disturbed by their rowdiness and by their mischievous pranks. And he suggested to his wife, Tiamat, that they should destroy these gods. Now she objected, but he insisted, saying, and I quote to you from the poem, "I will destroy them and put an end to their way, that silence may be established, and then let us sleep." And notice what this shows you about the gods. They are gods who get married, they are gods who are tired, they are gods who get old, they are gods who want to sleep and be left alone. When the other gods heard of this plan to kill them, they were filled with dismay. And so they had a conference with Ea, who is noted for his wisdom. And Ea said, well, he was not only noted for his wisdom, but the wisdom included magic, you see. He said he would cast a spell on Apsu, and this is what he did, causing him to fall into a deep sleep. And when Apsu was in a deep sleep, he took from him his crown and then killed him. So the god dies. Now Ea was even more famous than he was before, and soon there was born to him this son named Marduk. Now Marduk was larger in physical size than all the other gods, and he had two faces and twice as much power as all the others. Now in the meantime, Tiamat, the old lady, had taken another husband called Kingu. And Kingu and some of the gods persuaded her and said, well, look, you shouldn't take the death of your first husband lightly. You ought to get vengeance for his murder. And so she was persuaded to do that. So to the dismay of all the other gods, they learnt of this. So here you've got now the baddies and the goodies, right? The bad gods, the evil gods, under Kingu and Tiamat, and the good gods under Ea. And they sent for Ea and said, well, look, there's a terrible situation here. You must cast a spell upon her as you did upon her first husband. Well, he tried to do so, but he failed. So there's much consternation among the gods. What should they do? And then suddenly, of course, they remembered about the son of Ea's, Marduk, the god with two faces and with great physique. And he came in, and all the assembly of gods, you know, looked upon him and said that he is the champion. And so they asked him to do so. Now he was a god that saw the best side of a bargain and said, oh yes, he said, I'll go on condition. Condition that I should become the chief of the gods. So they granted that concession to him. So he set off and he succeeded in killing Tiamat. He split her in half, cast one half up into the air to form the heaven, and the other half down to form the earth. Here's your creation story, you see. He then created places in the sky for the other great gods. Now these became the star gods. And then he created a place for the moon in the sky and the moon goddess. And then he created a place for the sun, building gates in the east and west for the sun to enter and to depart. Now then, what about these rebel gods who had been supporting Tiamat? Well, they were made into servants of Marduk and the good gods. So all the baddies are made servants of the good, victorious gods. And they had to work hard to provide the other gods with food and drink. But they got tired of this. They found it was very heavy work. So they came to Marduk and asked for relief. So he decided to set them free. But what he did was to kill their leader, Kingu, and out of his blood to make mankind. Now this was done, and mankind was made to take the place of the gods who had been set free from their burden of feeding the others. So mankind is created out of the blood of an evil god, and he is created to serve the gods with food. Marduk is, of course, the object of much thankfulness by all the other gods. And so they build the city of Babylon in his honor, with a great temple called Eskila, dedicated to Marduk. And finally, they honor him by giving him 50 names representing all the famous among the gods, and so making him supreme. Now that, in brief, is the Babylonian story of creation. Now, why go over this? Well, I'll tell you why. In 1846, a man by the name of Layard discovered the ruins of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. And excavations were carried on from 1846 to 1876. And during those excavations, they discovered fragments of this epic poem. Since then, other fragments have been found, and they've been pieced together to give the story that I've just told you. Now, there is a dispute among scholars as to all the details of it, but really, we do have the greater part of the story available to us at the moment. And it was found in Nineveh in the Assyrian language, in the great library of Ashurbanipal the emperor. Now this man ruled from 668 to about 640. And Ashurbanipal was a great copier. That is, he was interested in ancient history. You may say, well, 660 BC, what ancient history was there? Well, there were several thousand years of history before that, you see. And so what he got his scribes to do was to copy up literature from an earlier period. And so this particular poem, written in the Assyrian language, is really a copy of an earlier poem in the Babylonian language. And so scholars, as you can understand, have been trying to ferret out how old the poem is. And it used to be claimed until quite recently that it stems from the days of Hammurabi, the great Babylonian king, round about 1700-1700 BC. But more careful examination recently suggests that the poem is not quite as old as that, that it probably comes from about 1400-1300 BC. Now that's the days of Moses, or Moses maybe a little bit before that. I know there are different dates suggested by scholars for Moses, but I take the earlier date. And that's a matter that we'll look into perhaps some other time. But the point I want to make is this. I think we can put this off now. Thank you. The point I want to make is this. That when these discoveries were made in Nineveh in the last century, scholars began to say, the Bible story of creation is not as old as the Babylonian story. Because at the same time as these discoveries were made, biblical scholars were trying to say that the first three chapters of Genesis, and indeed the whole of Genesis, were not written by Moses at all. That they were written by unknown people, and that there were various documents, and they didn't know who the authors of the documents were, so they gave them certain letterings, J, E, D, and P. J for the document in which the word Jehovah was used, E for the document in which the name Elohim was used for God, D would be the book of Deuteronomy, and the P would be a book written by priests. Now they said that the story of creation in chapter 1 was written by the priests, and they said that that was the latest document, and that instead of being written in the days of Moses, around about 1400 BC, it wasn't written until the time when the people of Israel were in Babylon, in the captivity, in the year 586 onwards. Now you see what they're getting at? They are saying the story of creation in Genesis is really something that the Jews learned from the Babylonians, and that the story of creation in Genesis is a purified form of this story that I've just put on the overhead projector. Now just try and put yourself back into the middle of the 19th century. Up until then, you had Christian people believing the Bible is the Word of God, right? 1846, you have this discovery of this Babylonian epic. And of course, it appears in all scholastic books, and preachers begin to read about it, magazines begin to write about it, and it is introduced as an interesting story. Then comes the theory, it is older than the book of Genesis. Then comes the point, the book of Genesis depends upon it. And so you see what is happening. They're saying the book of Genesis is not a unique book. The story of creation in the Bible is not special. It is a myth. It is like the Babylonians. It is a purification of the Babylonians. And 1846 to 1876, that's the period of the excavations. 1859, you remember, was the theory of evolution with Darwin. And therefore, you've got a three-pronged attack on the Bible. You've got the theory of evolution saying nonsense regarding the story of creation in 6 days. You have the scholars coming in and saying, we have found, the archaeologists have found, and archaeology is a new science, the archaeologists have found creation stories that are old in the book of Genesis. Then these German biblical scholars came in and said, ah yes, the biblical story is derived from the Babylonian one. And you see, Christian people were under great pressure, are under great attack, and they didn't know how to answer these attacks. There were some men who did seek to answer the attacks of different documents within the Bible, within the book of Genesis, and they answered them very well. But you know what the scholars did? They ignored them. That's a very strange thing. There were two men, one man called W.H. Green, another man called Finn, and they gave a point-to-point answer, brilliant answer, to these theories of different documents in the book of Genesis. But they were completely ignored, brushed aside, never referred to, and these liberal scholars kept repeating their arguments from textbook to textbook to textbook, and in the colleges and universities, those that had defended the scriptures were never quoted, and the students were never told to read their books. Now, it's surprising how Satan can get by in that way. Answers were given to the attacks on the Bible, but the answers were ignored. Well, now, here, therefore, you see that what we've got by today is a general feeling that the Bible cannot be relied upon. The theory of evolution, the Babylonian story of creation, the idea that there are several documents making up the book of Genesis, and that those documents were written at a much, much later period than the days of Moses. Now, the scholars go on to say that there is a lot of similarity between the story of creation in the Bible and the story of creation in Babylon. And no doubt if any of you have been studying biblical studies at the university here in Bangor, you will have been familiar with this point of view. And scholars will emphasize the similarities. Now, in actual fact, the similarities are very, very few. Really, there are only three points of contact between the two narratives. First of all, that there was a watery beginning, right? Apsu, Tiamat, and Mumu, you know, the sea water, the salt water, sweet water, salt water, and the mist. Scriptures tell us, don't they, in the book of Genesis, that in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void, and there was darkness on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved on the face of the waters, hovering over the waters. That's the only point of contact there, that there was water at the beginning, and you get that in the Babylonian story as well. The second point of contact is that the heavens were created. You have the sun, moon, and stars. But you notice that in the Babylonian story, the stars come first, and the moon second, and the sun afterwards. Now, they were worshippers of the planets, and so you get the stars first. It's very interesting that in the Bible, the stars are referred to almost, you know, by the way. We are told that God made two great lights, it says in chapter 1 of Genesis, verse 16. The greater light, the sun, to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. Thrown in, you know, also made the stars. A very good point, you know, when you're dealing with people who are always looking to see what the stars have to say. They say, well, have you ever thought of him who made the stars? He also made the stars. And the third point of contact is that he created man. But apart from those three general facts, that the two narratives refer to a beginning in which there's water everywhere, and the fact that the heavens were created, and the fact that man was created. But those are the only points of similarity. You see, the Babylonian story doesn't speak of the creation of light. Genesis, God said, let there be light. There was light. But in the Babylonian story, Marduk is full of light, and Ea is full of light, and Apsu is radiating light. So they are talking of light before the creation. Consequently, you see, there are more differences than there are similarities. In addition, you can say that in the Babylonian story, there is no reference to the creation of vegetation. Many things that are left out. Many things indeed. And those differences are far greater than the similarities. Let me remind you of something else. The purpose of man's creation, according to the Bible, is far, far superior to the one in the Babylonian. In the Babylonian story, man is created to be a slave of the gods, to feed them, literally to feed them with his sacrifices. But in the scriptures, we read that God paused in his creation in chapter 1, verse 26, and said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that moves along the ground. So God created man in his own image, not in the image of an evil god like King Ul. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. And God says, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth. You see, God honors man. Man is the supreme created being. Everything is created for your benefit. He's not created to be a slave. He's created a free person. Everything will be yours for food, and so on. I give every green plant for food, everything for you. Well, now then, there's a total difference in environment and spiritual atmosphere in the two narratives. What is the easiest thing to do? To purify a corrupt narrative or to corrupt a purified narrative? In other words, if I ask one of you to stand on a chair and I take your hand and I ask you, you pull me up, I can easily pull you down. And this is it, isn't it? Human nature being corrupt and sinful, corrupts a pure narrative. In the Bible, among the Jews, the truth that God had given was preserved. But among the nearby cultures who were not part of the Jewish people, there was some kind of folk memory of the truth that had been handed down from generation to generation. But it quickly got corrupted. And they mixed it up with their own imaginations. Now, as far back as 1942, a man in Chicago, a professor of Oriental Studies in Chicago, a man called Alexander Heidel, made a close survey of this so-called Babylonian story of creation, and he said this: I reject the idea that the biblical account gradually evolved out of the Babylonian. For that, the differences are far too great, and the similarities are far too insignificant. In the light of the differences, the resemblances fade away almost like the stars before the sun. It's surprising, you see, that in scholarly works there'll be a reference to Alexander Heidel's book in the footnotes, but no real grappling with his arguments. And that's another example of liberal scholars ignoring what is not convenient to them. Now, you might think that in a university you are in the midst of people of great integrity and great honesty and great search for truth. Well, let me tell you, it isn't so. That in a university you find as much sin as you find outside the university. And you'll find people with presuppositions, and you'll find people with their own particular viewpoints, and you'll find them being tempted to be dishonest, just as other people are tempted to be dishonest. And it's surprising how very few academics are prepared to stand away from the main academic stream and to make a statement which they know is unpopular in their own circle, and if they stick to their point of view, they may lose the possibility of having a professorial chair. University lecturers, university professors are sinners just the same as the dustman, the butcher, the baker, the teacher, the preacher, and everybody else. We must remember that. Scientists are the same. They have their presuppositions. And you find this in the whole history of human thought. Well, now, let us look at the Babylonian story of the fall of man. And you see this again as being so different. This is called the legend of Adapa, A-D-A-P-A. And Adapa had been created by this god of wisdom, Ea. And he'd been granted divine wisdom, granted the wisdom of God, of the gods, but he'd not been granted eternal life. So one day, as Adapa was out on the Persian Gulf catching fish for the temple of Ea, the south wind suddenly arose and overturned his boat. Now Adapa lost his temper, was so angry, that he cursed the wind, thus breaking one of the wind's wings, so that for 7 days it did not blow the cool breezes over the hot land. Now Adapa, of course, is called to appear before the sky god Anu for such a misdemeanor, and to give an account of his deed. Well, before he comes before the tribunal of Anu, he is given instructions by Ea. Ea says, now look, if you want to get out of this spot, out of this difficulty, you've landed yourself in a very difficult spot, if you want to get out of it, well then, you better do as I say. And these were the instructions. He clothed himself with a mourning garment, a garment of bereavement, and let his long hair hang down. And when he appeared at the gate of heaven, there were two gods there who were gatekeepers, and they asked him, what is the matter? Why are you mourning? And he said, well, I've been looking for you two. You used to live on the earth, and you've suddenly disappeared, and I've missed you. Of course, they swelled with pride, and so they were very pleased with what he had said, and they brought him in a very favourable manner before the sky god, and defended him before the sky god Anu. And the result was that he was offered by the sky god food of life and water of life. And if he had taken them, he would have lived forever. But Ea had warned him, be careful you don't take the food of death and the water of death. So of course he thought to himself, well, this must be the food of death and the water of death. So he refused them. And by refusing them, he lost having eternal life. That is supposed to be the fall of man. Now can you see, it is shot through and through with major differences with the biblical story. You find that Adapa has to deal not with one god, but with several gods. You have also the fact that Adapa is not sinless before his so-called fall. You know, he was peeved, he cursed the wind. Also, we find that whereas Adam and Eve are represented as having been created perfect and as being tempted by the devil, you can hardly say that the south wind tempted Adapa to lose his temper. What is more, before eternal life, Adapa obviously was peevish and he could be deceived. And you also find that the god Ea is working against the sky god, so there is wickedness among the gods, there is deceit among the gods. You find the gatekeeper gods, they are proud and arrogant, and so there is sin among the gods. So what you've got really in the Babylonian story is that sin has always existed, even among the heavenlies. They have no concept of a god of holiness. They have no concept of man being created in holiness. They have no idea of the depth of the fall, of the catastrophe of the fall of man. The favor that Adapa is supposed to have from the sky god, of course, he doesn't get it because he was duped, he was deceived by his own wrong decision. Well, now then, you can see already that the atmosphere of the Bible and the atmosphere of the Babylonian stories are very, very different. Now, let me quote Alexander Heidel once again. He says, in Genesis, man is created in the image of God. And then notice this, but the Babylonians created their gods in the image of man. Man is wicked, so the gods are wicked. That's a very, very apt statement. The Babylonian gods are just like men and women thrown up into the sky, living forever in the middle of their sin, full of jealousy and pride and wickedness and adultery and deceit and all the rest of it. But they're no different from men except that they're powerful and that they live forever. What were the Babylonians worshipping? They were worshipping the devil. They were worshipping the devil. That's what it was. It was the devil masquerading in this manner. Now, is there any difference between that and the worshipping of chance? Man's life, accidental. Man's life, man's origin, just accidental combination of factors leading up to the theory of evolution and so on. That's all is man's life. But isn't blind chance exactly the same as the gods that we were reading of in Psalm 115? If life is pure chance, if this universe is just the result of a big bang, if it all happened, you know, nobody knows how, therefore, chance, well, it's not made of silver and gold, but it's covered with the silver and gold of scientific thought and philosophy, and it seems very, very precious. Well, chance, mouths but cannot speak, eyes but they cannot see, ears but they cannot hear, noses where they cannot smell. What has scientific rationalism got to offer you? No comfort at all. You can't pray to scientific rationalism. You can't pray to the God of chance. You can't pray to the theory of evolution. You can't, in other words, you're in the universe on your own. And you don't know what's going to happen by the time you leave this building. And you have no comfort if the most terrible disaster came upon you. And if your life is snuffed out this evening, then it's snuffed out and that's all there is to it. It's a dead hope among dead gods. And although we change the names and don't call them idols anymore, surely in scientific rationalism and in humanism and in evolutionary thinking, man is worshipping man. So what kind of god is he worshipping? The same as Apsu and Tiamat, they were evil. So man is worshipping an image of himself, which is evil. And from himself, he gets no answer that is going to satisfy his never-dying soul. So although, therefore, the culture may be different today to what it was then, basic to it all is the same thing. That man's corrupt mind is prolific in producing another form of worship, which doesn't satisfy, but which blocks him out from the living God. And so you see this. Creation, fiction. And I would say that the evolutionary theory is a fiction. And the idea that everything came into being by chance is a fiction. God has revealed to us the truth. You've got creation truth already here in Genesis 1, 2 and 3. Other theories are human theories and as corrupt as their makers. What do you expect a man to do out of his gold and silver except a dead god? What do you expect a man to do if he is unconverted with his thinking powers but to produce dead hypotheses and dead philosophies which are of no comfort? And you see, somebody mentioned this some time ago, the liberal theology that began in the last century is something you cannot preach. There's nothing gripping about it. It doesn't convert a soul. So the chapels are empty. That's why they're empty. The chapels are empty because the theories that were preached were not convincing to the ordinary man. The ordinary man is not dull. The ordinary man can smell death. What's the point of going to church? I can remember, going back some considerable time, before the war and after the war, and the Sunday schools of Wales, the adult Sunday schools, were full. And when I was a child and when I was a young man, we had large classes of men and women in the adult Sunday school. And we went there every Sunday afternoon and we argued till we were blue in the face and we had a wonderful time. Ah, I gave him so-and-so, I gave him so-and-so. One way next week, no, what's next week? But you see, you came out just as when you went in. It was a great debating club. But you're not subject to the Word of God. Now the war came. People went away into the forces and into the armament factories. And they were forced to work on the Sunday. And they had 5-6 years of not going to a place of worship. When they came back, they'd lost interest. Why go and just argue about a theory? The gospel according to Mr. Jones, as one person said to me, you know, referring to himself. In other words, the war simply revealed the spiritual bankruptcy that was already there before the war. It wasn't the war that emptied the churches. The people were in the churches before the war, but they were without Christ, many of them. So the war just gave them the opportunity to see that they could live a Christless life without going to a place of worship. So they came back, those that did, and they just didn't come back to the churches. But the vacuum, the spiritual vacuum, had been there before the war came. Liberal theology has no comfort and empties the churches. And it is the cry of our hearts that God again might bring back the truth of his word into this spiritual wilderness in which we live. and that men and women might recognize that in the scriptures you are told of the living God who does answer prayer, and the exhortation of the psalm, O house of Israel, trust in the Lord. He is their help and shield. May the Lord make you increase, both you and your children. May you be blessed by the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. Now, I want you to notice another factor, that in the Old Testament, the history part of the Old Testament is always referring back to the creation and to the flood. The two things. I was very saddened to know that the IVP have just published a book, Genesis 12 to 50. Now, why do such a thing? Are they suggesting, you see, in Genesis 12, you're starting with the story of Abraham. Historical. Safely historical. Archaeological evidence to indicate the background of Abraham's period. But Genesis 1 to 11, you know, creation in 6 days, and the fall, and the Tower of Babel, and Cain and Abel, and, well, we're not so sure, is that historical? Is that the thinking between the IVP? Will they ever publish a book on Genesis 1 to 11? Why make a brick? Why not have a commentary Genesis 1 to 50? Why Genesis 12 to 50? Is that the influence again of this liberal theology? I'm putting this challenge because, you see, there are now a number of evangelical publishers who are not as evangelical as they were when they first started. They are not as evangelical as they were. They include many voices, some more evangelical than others. And so you have a variety of books published by the same evangelical publisher. And some evangelical publishers have compromised profoundly, profoundly, and are producing books now that would never have been produced by them a number of years ago. This is the subtleness of it all. Remember that the scriptures are under constant attack by the devil. They are under constant attack by the devil. And it's so easy for us to slide into a position of compromise almost without realizing it. Almost without realizing it. And you notice that this is happening, you see, not among those who are declaring themselves to be liberal theologians, but it is subtly coming into evangelical circles. It's a very, very insidious thing. The wiles of the devil, we have been told in the scriptures, but we are not unmindful of the wiles of the devil. Now we must be very sure that we are on our guard, vigilant and watchful and prayerful.